This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. If you've been following the news recently, you've probably seen reports of volcanic activity around the world. Bartabunga in Iceland, lava flows in Hawaii, and that viral video of a powerful blast with a shockwave off the coast of Papua New Guinea. We saw them too and thought, well, that's a lot of volcano news. Does it mean anything? And just how much do we know about volcanoes anyway? So that's when we called our first guests. Elizabeth Cottrell is a geologist and the director of the Global Volcanism Program at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. She joins us from Washington today. Welcome.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Also joining us is Cynthia Ebinger, a professor of geophysics in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. She is at the studios of WXXI. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me.
And if you've got volcano questions for our volcano experts, give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. If you're on Twitter, you can always tweet us at SciFry. And for more on what we're going to be talking about all this hour, go to sciencefriday.com, where you will find some links to our topic. So first, Liz Cottrell, I'll start with you. We talk about all these volcanoes in the news. Is this all normal volcanic activity?
Yes, it is normal activity. We are actively reporting on 23 eruptions now, and that's fairly typical. There are around 8 volcanoes with new activity, but we typically average around 25 volcanoes a week that we report on.
And some of them get a lot more press than others. Why do we hear about some volcanoes? We don't hear so much about others.
I think that when volcanoes affect the lives of people in wealthier nations, especially when they affect air travel, or a threat to air travel, we hear about them a lot more in the news, such as the 2010 eruption in Iceland, or this current activity in Iceland threatens to inhibit people's ability to do business, and then we hear about it more. Whereas there are other large eruptions that don't make the news so much, even if they cause fatalities.
And of course, a lot of these eruptions are happening in places where there aren't, you know, a real big concentration of scientists. Is that part of it, too, where scientists are, we're going to spend more time studying those volcanoes?
That's absolutely the case. It's definitely easiest to study something in your backyard. Although I study volcanoes and I live in Washington, D.C., so.
So you don't have too many there. And there are a lot more than we can even see, many, many more underwater. Give us a sense of how much volcanic activity there is happening at the bottom of the ocean.
Well, most of the Earth's volcanic activity does occur under the ocean where we can't see it, about 75%. And if you can picture the oceans, down the center of many of the oceans, there's a chain of volcanoes, a ridge, like a fissure, as we have in Iceland now. And new magma is constantly coming to the Earth's surface and creating new continental new oceanic crust, creating new land, essentially, all the time. And there are thousands of these volcanoes on the ocean floor erupting all the time.
So, Cindy Ebinger, you study what's going on underneath a volcano. How exactly do you do that?
We use a multitude of methods because we're using inference. We can't actually see, so the more methods that we can use and apply in this situation, the better. The most common one is monitoring the levels of earthquakes, and every volcano so far studied, or most volcanoes, have their own pulse or their own style of activity. So some have very few earthquakes until they're just about to erupt. Bartabunga is one of those volcanoes like that. There's another Hengel in Iceland that gives us a bit of advance warning, maybe 12, 24 hours in advance before an eruption. Other volcanoes have a lot of activity, and we see a prolonged increase over time. So we monitor volcanoes with the volcano earthquakes. We also monitor shape changes in the volcanoes, and we can do that through a variety of methods. We can have continuously recording GPS receivers on the volcanoes and have people monitor those. We can use satellite observations. So imagine getting a very detailed topographic image of a volcano and then making a repeat measurement a month later, measuring the differences between the two and seeing these shape changes. And if we see consistent patterns or local changes, small changes in a large changes in one small area, then we might send folks out to the field or actually even give alerts or look to evacuation programs as well. And we can also monitor gas emissions. We can monitor those with satellites if they're large volume emissions or with ground-based observations as well.
So you can actually see from satellite imagery enough changes on the surface, say, of a volcano to know that something different is happening here?
That's right. We can see changes at less than a centimeter. We have that kind of accuracy with the satellite observations. And these give us like a map view image. If there's a lot of vegetation on a volcano, it's hard to do. If in many volcanoes, the vegetation is sparse because there have been active lava flows. And so we can look in these places. But if we see these small changes that are consistent over time, then we start to interpret then density changes within the volcano. And these can be caused by magma rising up and gases coming out of solution and expanding as the pressure is released. And so that can cause shape changes in the volcano. It also would cause more earthquakes because those are pressurizing and causing small cracks to open up as the gases are escaping from the volcano.
We're talking about volcanoes with Cynthia Ebinger and Elizabeth Cottrell, and we'll take some of your questions in just a moment, some of your volcano questions. We've got some fairly simple ones, though, for you, just to clear up some ideas for us. So, Cindy, tell us, underneath a volcano, right, we can picture in a movie this giant tank of liquid rock just bubbling away and ready to blow. Does it look like that? Do we know?
This is it's like a Hollywood myth that we have this bubbling cauldron of molten rock that's going to come to the surface. And in fact, there are crystals that have been forming inside these volcanoes that may be 1,000 years old or even older than that. They've been forming inside. So there's a small amount of magma and then it's mostly just like a mush zone, I think, is one of the ways that folks have looked at this. It's slightly hotter than other zones. One of the things we do with the earthquake information is we look at small variations in the velocity structure using something like CAT scan techniques with these earthquakes. As we map out where the velocity is a little bit slower, so the rocks are probably a bit hotter than others, and we try and get a good idea of the shape of these magma containers or magma chambers. But within them, then, there might be 10% melt. That'd be a lot. You might have a lens of liquid at the top, but it's not a molten cauldron at all.
So here's another simple question. Liz Cottrell, the difference between the volcanoes that we see oozing the red lava slowly out and the ones that go boom and blast out all the ash out the top, what's the difference in these two types?
The two types basically fall along what we call in different tectonic settings. The surface of the Earth is made up of tectonic plates, and these are shifting, the volcanoes are located along the edges of these plates. And the style of volcanism that we see relates to the composition of the magma. So, for example, in Iceland is actually what we call a plume or a hot spot that is actually co-located with one of these long chains of ocean volcanoes at the mid-ocean ridge. And we're seeing there melts that are directly related to melting the Earth's mantle. And we have a lot of iron and magnesium that makes the magma low viscosity. And so bubbles can escape, and we get kind of these more passive eruptions of lava. Now, if we change our focus to arcs like the Cascades, the Andes, Japan, the Philippines, the Aleutians in Alaska, where we have the ocean floor subducting down into the deep earth, we have water being released, and we get a lot more incorporation of the continental crust into those magmas. It raises the silicon content, makes the magma very viscous, but is still able to flow, but very viscous, and that can trap and pressurize, and the pressure builds up and up until we get a pressure release, and then we get those big kapow eruptions.
If you have volcano questions, you can call us 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Let's go to David, who's calling from Sarasota, Florida. Hi there, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. Yeah.
My question's regarding global warming and the thawing of the polar ice caps at the increased weight of the water. Would that increase the movement on the tectonic plate by the weight alone that we're seeing historically, more volcanic activity and earthquakes?
Well, thanks for the question, David.
I could...
Okay, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that that's a really excellent question, and it's a very active area of research, actually. People are looking at this actively. We see changes potentially in the amount of volcanism that we see worldwide due to unloading of the ice sheets that causes less pressure, and actually less pressure at the surface. There are theoretical reasons and some data to support the idea that that causes more volcanic activity, and people are now looking for this in the oceans as well as on land in the eruption record.
Do you have something to add to that?
Yes, I do. The other situation is in rising sea level. There are many volcanoes that are near coastlines or actually form the coastlines as well. And one of the bad situations with volcanoes is getting the hot magma or just the hot rocks close to water, because the water then can be vaporized and cause an explosion, and a lot of that's not a good situation to be in as well. And so as sea level rises and we have water in places that there wasn't, we may expect to find cracks that open or allow water in, and we would see an increase in the number of these kinds of interactions as well.
We're talking about volcanoes and taking some of your volcano questions with Cynthia Ebinger, who is a professor of geophysics at the University of Rochester, and Elizabeth Cottrell, who is from the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. We'll be back to answer some more of your questions right after the short break. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking this hour about volcanoes. We've seen a lot of volcanoes in the news, and we want to find out a bit more about what's happening with Elizabeth Cottrell from the Smithsonian Institution and Cynthia Ebinger from the University of Rochester. We're taking some of your phone calls, and we're also getting a lot of tweets, and here's the big question we're getting a lot of: the Yellowstone supervolcano. What can you tell us about this?
Yellowstone is a volcano. It hasn't had a major eruption in a very long time, but it is active. It's a mantle plume, actually very much like Iceland, in that it's a stationary, you can think of it as a stationary hotspot, the geostationary hotspot that is kind of burning the bottom of the continent there. And you can see the long Snake River Plain hotspot track. So it's very similar to Iceland, only it's under a continent.
Is there any concern, as some people are asking us, about any human activity, like hydrofracking in the area, that might cause some disturbance with this volcano?
One of the things that folks are, with earthquake seismology, we've been able to see time variations in the magma volume shape. And using some relatively new techniques, using background levels of noise, just regular noise, not a sound source that we created, we can use this. And so we're starting to see some of these small changes. But the kinds of pressure changes associated with hydrofracking are so small in comparison to the level of or the kinds of triggers that we would expect to say for a massive eruption. Changing the groundwater table over long periods of time may increase the chance of a volcanic eruption. And so, but it's not even clear that fracking can influence the groundwater table. It's usually done below that. So I think this fracking interaction is probably a sidebar and a very small component of the whole earthquake prediction story.
I also like to say it's not really worth worrying too much about Iceland erupting Yellowstone erupting, because if we had the magnitude of eruption as in the past, we would all just be wiped out. So
Well, that's very reassuring. And that's one of the questions, too. Would it affect the Eastern Seaboard? Well, it would affect all of us, eh?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it would be global in scope if we had an eruption of the magnitude that Yellowstone has been capable of in the past.
I like it as well. That's all the time we have. No, we'll continue. That's not too hopeful. Let's go to somebody who has a question about the Icelandic volcanoes. Joe's in Harpers Ferry, Iowa. Go ahead. Hi, Joe. You're on the air. We'll move on from Joe because Joe's not there. Maybe Chandler is there to ask a question about Iceland. Hi, Chandler. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering what the scientists' thoughts were on the threat posed by the high sulfur levels in Iceland's volcanoes.
Sulfur dioxide is definitely one of the main hazards from volcanoes. It actually also relates to climate change, just hearkening back to the earlier caller. It can be bad for crops, bad for livestock, bad for people. It causes volcanic smog or VOG that we also get in Hawaii. So it definitely is a threat in Iceland. Cynthia?
Yeah, and downwind from these the SO2 clouds, then these particles, SO2 particles, the sulfur dioxide particles, will be frozen as aerosols up in the atmosphere, but then they may be rained out as acid rain or come out as acid rain then someplace downwind from them. And these plumes then can travel very large distances, particularly in equatorial volcanic eruptions where they can impact global weather fairly quickly.
Liz Contrell, part of your research looks at the chemistry of rocks from deep inside the Earth. Why is this important? What can it tell us?
Yeah, volcanoes are an excellent source of rocks. They bring rocks from very deep in the Earth where we can't sample using any technology that we have. So, in my research, I really rely on volcanoes to bring rocks to the surface for me to study. The mantle of the Earth is, our Earth is solid rock underneath, and the magmas and the lavas that we see at the surface form very close to the surface. So we do have a solid rock underneath there. But even though it's solid, it's still convecting. You can almost imagine how if you left a jar of honey upside down in your freezer, it might still flow if you waited, and you could observe that on long timescales. And that's like the mantle of our planet. And differences in chemistry around the globe can tell us about the history of our planet, the history of life, the history of subduction, how our planet formed initially, and just get a bearing on the overall trajectory of our planet and how much heterogeneity is left there. And that's and how life-giving element cycles such as carbon and oxygen and hydrogen, water, carbon dioxide, everything like that. So that's what I study in my research.
And very much different rocks that you'd find coming up out of a volcano in, say, Hawaii than one in Iceland?
Well, Hawaii and Iceland are actually quite similar. You would get different kinds of rocks typically because Hawaii and Iceland are both hot spots. And they're both located in the ocean. And so we see something really different coming from those subduction zone arc volcanoes like we have in the Cascades, the United States, or the Philippines. But the underlying mantle, those rocks are, if you were to look at them with your hand, if you as a member of the public were to look at them, they would look very similar to your eye, but the chemistry, the underlying chemistry would still be different.
So, Cindy Ebinger, I think an important question for a lot of us is how close are we to being able to predict with some accuracy a volcanic eruption? I mean, where are we right now? How soon do you know when something is going to happen? How much of a time can you give someone to get out of an area at this point?
It's a great question to ask. For volcanoes like Hawaii, where there's been a volcano observatory for 50 years and long records then, of measuring the pulse or establishing a baseline, we can monitor change. And the systematics of that volcano are pretty well understood. The Icelanders have built a fantastic database for their volcanoes, many active volcanoes, and feel their pulse or understand changes in patterns on those. So in those places, I think we feel very Cascadia, the west coast of the U.S., some of the volcanoes in Alaska, we feel fairly confident in being able to give hours, days of advance notice for evacuation. One of the areas where I'm working right now is the East African Rift, where it's studded with active volcanoes, or that where their history is very poorly understood. We keep finding more and more of them that are showing shape changes or others indicating active magma chambers beneath. So for those, we haven't really a clue of their history, their patterns of eruption, and so we couldn't make a prediction except to say that we need to observe more, make more measurements, and start to educate people about the potential hazards.
I want to get to a call here. John is on the line. Hi there, John. Go ahead. Oh, we don't have John quite yet. I have to ask you one thing about whether or not pressure is actually released. When one volcano blows, are other volcanoes in that same chain, are they then relieved of some of the pressure? Might they not then blow up as easily? Does it work that way?
Well, the feeding between different volcanoes. Okay, so a volcano blows. Some volcanoes can actually have a massive blast and remove a lot of rock. Folks think of Mount St. Helens in that way. And so it depends on how close that additional volcano would be to it, that if a pressure release there could influence it. You can go to a place, areas like the Galapagos, where there are volcanoes separated by 30, 40 kilometers, and a large blast on one would most likely cause a change in pressure in the nearby volcanic system because they have shallow magma chambers and they're very closely spaced. So closeness and the distribution of the magma underneath then is the biggest factor in that situation.
And it can work the other way, too. I think many people will remember the 2010 eruption of Eyjafjallajökull in Iceland. In that case, our eruptive database told us that when that was occurring, that three of the last four times that volcano erupted, its neighbor also erupted. So instead of reducing the hazard or depleting the chance, it actually we were poised to see an eruption nearby because we saw that eruption.
Now I think we have John with his question quickly from California. Hi there, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for a very interesting discussion, and thanks for taking my call. My question is, in Hawaii, I know the Hawaiians have two words for the types of lava. Mm-hmm. I think they refer to the liquid-like flowing lava as pahoehoe, and the real stiff, slow-moving stuff as ah-ah. So I was wondering if volcanologists around the world have adopted these two words to refer to lava this way, or whether people in different countries call them by different names as far as scientific studies are concerned.
John, great question. Thank you so much. Who wants to tackle that one?
It's easy. Those are, I'm sure Cynthia will agree, those are used universally by scientists.
And part of the reason I certainly use ah-ah is because that's exactly the way I feel when I walk over it. Ah.
But I'm assuming that there are all sorts of other terms that you've heard in Iceland with these other languages as well, right? Do people have other words for lava that you've learned, Liz, over the years?
Or maybe not lava, but there's many terms, for example, from the Icelandic language, like Jökulhlaup is the word for an ice. This is one of the major hazards in Iceland from volcanoes when you have melting of the glaciers that overlie the volcanoes, and that can cause massive melting and the ice dam to break and cause very catastrophic local flooding. And Jökulhlaup is the Icelandic word, and it's used by scientists around the world to describe that phenomenon even when we're not on Iceland.
I asked you that question just to have you say more words in Icelandic. Thank you. Elizabeth Kochel is a geologist and director of the Global Volcanism Program at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
And Cynthia Ebinger is a professor of geophysics in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York.